Welcome to the Commentary Magazine Daily Podcast. Today is Wednesday, May 20th, 2020. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, the 70-odd-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. We invite you, as always, to join us at commentarymagazine.com, where we are putting up the contents of our June issue today and tomorrow. We give you a few free reads and then ask you to subscribe. With me, as always, Senior Editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Senior Writer Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
Associate Editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And joining us today, commentary contributor and Bloomberg columnist Eli Lake, whose blockbuster piece a couple months ago, the FBI scandal, went into the misuse of the FISA courts and warrants and various things that typified the behavior of the James Comey FBI. And he has now followed that piece up with another in our June issue, now available at commentarymagazine.com, called The Railroading of Michael Flynn. Thanks for joining us again, Eli.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Great. So we'll get to Michael Flynn in a moment. Any updates, Corona things we want to talk about, aside from my favorite fact that our mayor Bill de Blasio, having declared that people would be pulled out of the ocean if they dared go into the ocean on Memorial Day weekend, then complained that beaches in Long Island were not going to be friendly enough to New Yorkers who were not allowed to swim in the ocean in New York City, but should be able to drive to Long Island to swim in their beach, to swim in their ocean. Thus proving that when you are an idiot, your idiocy literally knows no bounds. I mean, this may be the single dumbest political thing that I've ever seen. I can't think of anything quite as dumb as this ever. Anybody have a comparable dumbness, a dumb thing? Anybody? You say you're going to pull people out of the water, and then you complain that the beach 10 miles away is saying, well, don't come here if you're, you know, you're not allowed to come here. And then you say, that's not you. The person who said, we'll pull people out of the water, complains that that's unfair to his citizens who he was going to arrest for going into the water.
Well, the only dumb thing I saw a little closer here to Washington, D.C., was a bar in Ocean City, Maryland, which is going to open up by allowing some people have probably seen this story, that they're going to give them kind of walking intertubes to stand in, so that they can keep the 6-foot social distancing requirement. And they look like they literally have turned themselves into like human bumper cars when they wear them. But, you know, the young people, as they say these days, were like grinning and walking with their huge inner tube. You know, it almost looks like the old huge skirts they would wear in like the 18th century, the women. But at least, so they looked ridiculous, but at least it was trying to solve a practical problem to open things up so that everybody could partake. What de Blasio is doing, just, it really does make no sense. No sense. It just pisses people off, which is his forte lately.
Yeah, I mean, bars are opening up around the country without these bumper cars. And there was that German thing that we saw on Facebook, which I think actually turned out to be a joke.
What, the noodles?
People wearing, four perpendicular pool noodles on their head, which wouldn't constitute 6 feet anyway, but it just made you look ridiculous. But, I mean, that's preferable to that obnoxious, ridiculous situation. We're just turning ourselves into cartoons here on the basis of almost zero evidence. There's not sufficient clinical evidence to suggest that 6 feet is better than 5 feet or better than 8 feet. We don't know.
Okay, so Christine, you are a parent of junior high school age children in D.C. You,
yes.
Last night, a story broke in D.C. that the school system is planning to not open.
Right.
In the fall. They're planning not to open. At the same day that all these colleges are announcing their plans to open and have kind of rush schedules where they finish by Thanksgiving so everyone can go home. So when it gets really cold, they won't be there in case there's a second outbreak, blah, blah, blah. Let me posit a theory and have you guys react to it, that the places where we are hearing teachers and administrators talk about how, well, we can't possibly open up in the fall. We've got the California state system. We've got this public school system in DC, some other places, that private institutions, particularly colleges, private colleges, cannot so easily say, well, we're just not going to open up in the fall because they are looking at financial Armageddon. Publicly paid for institutions, where, by the way, teachers have a realistic prospect of getting paid exactly what they were paid before for staying home, not having to commute, working what are almost certainly shorter hours without having to do the kind of disciplinary organizational work that they have to do otherwise. There is a cracked incentive structure here where public school teachers may really want to stay home when their staying home will be so entirely destructive of the national economy that one can't even begin to think of it. There's going to be this lobbying arm in America that wishes to keep the country locked down because, as we've seen, not only is there this kind of incentive, but there is that fear about the unemployment incentive, that if the unemployment benefits are so generous that people are getting paid more than they would to go back to work, that it may be hard to get people to go back to work. I don't know if that's true. Obviously, financial incentives being what they are, financial incentives can have a kind of skewed effect on people. I'm concerned about the school thing in New York City. My kids don't go to public school, but the private schools all are dependent in some ways on the public school system. And if the public schools close, the private schools are going to be in a position powerfully, possibly necessary to close. Christine's got kids. She's in that situation. Noah's got kids. He's in that situation.
Well, as a someone without kids, but who comes from a family of teachers, and my partner is a college professor, I would just say that I think that you're probably right that there is a percentage of high school teachers who would love the convenience, I suppose, of teaching from home. But I know that there's a lot of other teachers who had to learn how to teach their classes under Zoom, and they ran into so many problems. They don't think it, and that there are a lot of people who I think are in the profession because they like teaching and they think it's a very noble calling, and that teaching through these remote things, there are a lot of issues just from the process that they don't have the same kind of connection. They don't reach kids the same way. And I've heard that just in my own personal interactions with my family and, as I said, my partner, who's a college professor. Right. And I think that there is a sense that they would, if they could get back in the classroom, if it was safe, they would much rather do that because, you know, this is what they do.
But well, John identified the public-private issue last night. We were texting about this. And yeah, it's absolutely a divide along the public-private issue. And it extends to universities as well. Like the UC system in California is planning on doing distance learning in the fall. But you're seeing increasingly from private universities like Notre Dame and NYU, they're planning on bringing students back in the fall because they can't survive unless they did that. So it's entirely a commercial decision. It has nothing to do with public health. And getting back briefly to the bar situation, because the more I think about it, it's driving me absolutely nuts. The stupid bumpers, it's all outside anyway, because you can't get through the door, right? And presumably you're not going to a bar alone. If you are, then that works for you. But if you're not, then you're with two other people, three other people with whom you're probably comfortable with, or maybe even living with, which defeats the entire purpose. All of this is all about liability. It has nothing to do with public health. It's about liability and commercial incentives for these institutions.
Well, and in D.C., it's really interesting because what the story that broke yesterday is the plan that Mayor Bowser is now considering has there are three separate plans they're considering, but all of them would have this system where some kids went to class for a few hours a day on some days of the week, but not every day, so they could keep classroom sizes down. This would be a nightmare. I mean, I'm going to next year have two high schoolers in two different public high schools in D.C. So that would mean, you know, the idea of families who need to, especially families with parents who need to go back into offices or into workplaces outside the home, this is going to be a nightmare for especially people with younger kids from a childcare perspective, because you're going to have these, you know, you're going to have to create these spreadsheets that somehow manage everybody's time for a few hours here or there. And I think there will be, I was on a Zoom meeting with a bunch of parents yesterday for one of my kids' high schools with the vice principals for their year. And those, I agree with Eli that the dedicated teachers really want to see this work, but none of them seem to really know which way it's going to go, because lots of parents asked these questions of these administrators, and they were like, we just have to wait to see what the mayor's going to do. So I think, again, it's kind of a version of the frustration that you all have expressed with de Blasio. Unless you have faith in the leadership of your city or state, it is extremely harrowing to try to plan for the fall right now if you're a parent. And that is going to have downstream effects for employment, because people with young children who are used to being able to put their kids in school all day and go to work aren't going to be able to do so.
Right. You know, with regard to the young children thing, I'm not a parent, but I think on social media, at least, and when I speak to people, I'm sensing a total split here among parents. For the most part, parents of kids who are high school age and younger are in a panic over, there's no way they can do this to me. You can't tell me that my kids won't be going back to school full time in the fall. Whereas the parents of college age kids are more saying, I don't know how I feel about sending my kid back to school, back to college. Am I comfortable with that? Do I feel secure in that? Is it safe? Is that because it's easier to have them around? I mean, occupy their time.
Just think about what a residential situation is like for a college age kid. That you might as well be sending them to prison. You are on top of each other in the most squalid conditions imaginable, with no regard for public hygiene. That's definitely a petri dish, and that's a source of major concern. Which is why NYU doing this residential school and Notre Dame doing this residential school doesn't make any public health sense.
Okay, here's the sense that it makes. It makes sense because an interruption of a year or a semester or something like that in the life of one of these schools, and you were talking about financial Armageddon. If you're a parent and you are aware of some of these concerns and that maybe they'll be there, but half their classes will get canceled, they're not learning anything or whatever, it's like, well, the hell with it. I'm not going to pay all that money to have this fake halfway experience. I'm already impoverishing myself to send my kids to college. So they'll take a year off. Kids take a year off all the time. Right. Like, what am I, crazy? This is ridiculous, and they could get sick.
If you're a parent of a college-age kid, you have a annual freak-out over meningitis every year. Right. There's always a death or a serious infection as a result of meningitis in these communal bathrooms.
Yeah.
So you can only imagine, you know, a pandemic.
Well, if you're a certain type of person and you're fearful of disease, and you're fearful of disease as a kind of constant sotto voce thing in your head, this is something that has come to the fore. I do not want to say, and I think it's very important, Eli's qualification is very important. Of course, there are 4 million educators in the United States, and many, many, many of them are dedicated, hardworking. It's a passion. It's a calling. It's horrible for them. What's going on here, not being able to make that personal connection with their students, to be in a classroom with their students, all of that. And I do not wish to belittle their feelings whatsoever. I just do think that there is a world in which people are looking at this and saying, look, I don't want to go back into one of these buildings where I could get sick. And the truth is, I'm a public employee. We have a contract. And, you know, my employment is not at risk here. So why can't we have it the best of all worlds? And we'll continue to do this until there's a vaccine.
I'm not saying we should ban college. I just think we need to shut it down until we find out what the hell is going on.
Right, exactly. Or high school. Right, exactly. Right. Anyway, so let's
by the way, I felt like that before coronavirus when I saw all the crazy PC stuff that was going on.
But I mean, you know, it's literally the case if you take New York City as an example. I mean, there are 1.1 million kids in school in New York City. If the schools don't open up in September, the notion that this leading financial edge city on earth isn't going to be plunged into a massive and unending depression is simply people aren't thinking rationally. Like, this is where we are going to get into that circumstance, I think, that I've been talking about for the last couple of weeks, where the consequences of a continued lockdown are going to be so severe that the political incentive for the people who are elected and who have to live and spend tax revenue and all that will be to deem the crisis over. There will be some point at which they will say, yay, we did it. We beat this virus. Let's get back to work. And, you know, obviously there's going to be some risk, but we got to do it. We got to do it and blah, blah, blah. And they'll just turn on a dime. Trump has made it very clear that you can turn on a dime in politics without all that, or Cuomo, Andrew Cuomo, who, of course, 2 days before he shut the state down, was poo-pooing and making fun of the idea of shutting the state down. So you can turn on a dime, and you can turn on a dime again. And the consequences of what we're talking about in terms of the fall are so monumental and so unprecedented and so fantastically destructive that there will be some kind of a weird emotional conspiracy in this country to shut, just as there was a moment at which it was impossible to say, I don't know about these lockdowns, where you would literally be terrified to say such a thing because you would get, you know, thrown off Twitter, you would get banned from Facebook, you know, you would get fired from your job, who knows what. And that this will somehow flip in the middle of July when everybody really wants to get back to work. I don't know if that's true, but that's my deepest theory.
In the meantime, now, I do want an intrepid young filmmaker to remake Ferris Bueller's Day Off post-pandemic, because it's like the entire script of kids doing anything possible to avoid school is now. I will be very curious to see how this generation that experienced this removal from that social setting will treat the experience of going back when they do, knock wood, hopefully sooner rather than later, get to go back.
Or it could flip, right? Ferris Bueller like breaks into school.
Right, exactly.
School, you know.
Ferris Bueller's Day On.
Yeah, anyway. Back. Right. Okay, so Eli Lake, the railroading of Michael Flynn. Michael Flynn, the incoming Trump's first national security advisor, fired or made to resign or whatever after 3 weeks in 2017, ostensibly for lying to the vice president, losing the confidence of Vice President Mike Pence because he supposedly told him a fib about a certain series of phone calls with the Russian prime minister. That fib, whatever, 11 months later leads to Flynn pleading guilty in the Robert Mueller investigation to lying to FBI agents. And then 2 years later, or 2.5 years later, the Justice Department investigates, recommends the dropping of the case, even though Flynn had pled guilty. And you spent 6,500 words laboriously and in detailed fashion explaining why what was done to Flynn was a great injustice and how it happened and what it means.
That's right. And I would just stress at the beginning that my interest in this, I mean, I've known Flynn kind of journalistically now for a long time. So I knew him when he was sort of at you know, in everybody's favor, when he was the kind of top intelligence officer for JSOC, which is the special operation sort of division of the U.S. military that, you know, hunts and kills terrorists and so forth. And, you know, he really revolutionized, you could argue, the war on terror in Afghanistan and Iraq. But that aside, I really think this is, on the one hand, it is about, it's a compelling story of the rise, fall, and redemption of a military general. But it's also a story of the corruption of James Comey's FBI and the outgoing Obama administration's Department of Justice. And that right there is the more consequential story for why it really matters to talk about this today. Because what happened, especially in the presidential transition, was, in my view, a crime against our democracy. And I know that sounds freighted, and I don't want to, I have been trying to be as measured as possible, but what happened was the director of the FBI decided to basically become the law himself, which we saw to a certain extent in the 2016 election cycle with how he decided to handle the information with Hillary by giving that press conference in which he said she did very bad things, but no reasonable prosecutor would ever go after her. But what happened after the transition is that the counterintelligence investigation was quite seriously into Mike Flynn had turned up nothing. They was ready to close on January 4th. There was a memo that
of 27 January 2017, January 4th, right, 2017, 2 weeks before Trump was inaugurated.
Right.
Right. So Flynn was being had the investigation into Flynn had started in the summer of 2016,
August,
and they were going to close it at the beginning of 2017.
Correct.
Right.
And the closing memo makes it clear that they looked into allegations, they didn't find anything, and they were ready to close it without ever interviewing him. And then Comey apparently directed, or his deputy directed an FBI you've talked about before, agent named Peter Strzok, to stop them from filing the memo, keep it open. And the reason that the FBI gave was because of a phone conversation, and there were other contacts, we should say, between Flynn and the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak. And I should say that at the time when all of this was playing out, we had reason to believe, because we didn't see the transcript, that there probably or there may have been something worse. We wanted to know what the FBI knew.
The transcript of the phone calls between Flynn and Kislyak is what you're referring to. Right.
Correct. Okay. And I get into a lot of detail in that piece. But the bottom line is that Flynn and Kislyak talk about a lot of things in that phone call. But when they do talk about the sanctions, which is this became the sort of genesis of the lie, like he didn't say to Vice President Pence that he had discussed sanctions. He was asked about it. There was a leak of the phone call to David Ignatius, which prompted
all these questions. Okay, very quickly, yeah. Just to pull back a little bit. Phone call involved the Obama administration had thrown out 35 spies from Washington and the United States in response to Russian meddling in the 2016 election and had levied some sanctions. And Flynn talks to Kislyak and says, don't retaliate.
And by the way, this is Kislyak was texting Flynn saying, I need to talk to you. Did you see what the Obama administration did? He was on vacation in the Dominican Republic.
Flynn was.
Flynn was. And then, so Flynn had prepared for this, we know this because of the Mueller report, that there were communications. I'm going to talk to Kislyak, and there was this conversations that the sanctions that Obama had just imposed would, make it more difficult to have, a better relationship with Russia. But there was never a discussion of a quid pro quo. We have to understand that in this period of January 2017, the FBI is aware, and soon the public becomes aware, of this garbage dossier that obsessed us for 2 years. And that, the central claim of that, well, there's a lot of claims, but the most important one for the purposes of the Russia investigation is that in exchange for releasing the damaging emails that were hacked by the Russians, and I suppose other kinds of interference, we know that they ran Facebook ads and things like that, that there was a deal. And the deal was, not through Michael Flynn, according to the Steele dossier, but someone named Carter Page, a low-level aide who had traveled to Moscow, that when Trump took power, that they would lift other sanctions, not the ones but the more serious ones that were imposed in 2014 for Russia's annexation of Crimea and invasion of Ukraine. So this was the kind of initial narrative of collusion. Sanctions relief in exchange for meddling. Now, when you, in that context, if the only information you leak is they discussed sanctions, then it appears worse than it really was, because what did Mike Flynn say? Don't escalate. That was what he, that was the sum total of the conversation. Don't get in a tit for tat. Don't ask. We haven't seen the transcript yet, but we can surmise that from his guilty plea. We can surmise it from now the declassified versions of what's known as a 302, which are the FBI agent interview notes with Mike Flynn. And we can surmise that also from the Mueller report, which never mentions the quid pro quo and discusses various versions of don't escalate. So don't escalate for an incoming national security advisor is not suspicious. And as the motion to drop the case says, that would be evidence that he was advocating for U.S. national interests, not undermining them. That is not a predicate to think that the guy is a spy. It's more exculpatory evidence that he's not a spy. And that's significant because they already had a lot of evidence that their investigation turned up no derogatory information that he was a spy. So then why was it kept open? And then in that context, the call leaks, that becomes a huge news story, and that creates the occasion for then Comey to come up with, I believe, his second, or depending on how you want to say, third explanation for sending FBI agents, which, by the way, he sends these FBI agents to interview Flynn by directly disobeying the wishes of the acting attorney general at the time, which is another hugely important development here. Which
that
is
important to say that acting attorney general Sally Yates is the person who, it's not like Sally Yates being opposed to this interview, being opposed to further going into Flynn, that Sally Yates was some kind of a Trump plant. She was fired days later for disobeying Trump's order to shut the airports down.
Right.
As I recall.
So-called Muslim ban. Right.
Right. So she wasn't like some Trump plant trying to defend Flynn. She was like, this is over. I thought the memo said that he was clear.
It's unclear that she even knew about the memo, by the way. Right. That's another part of this. But she believed, and not just Sally Yates, James Clapper, Obama's director of national intelligence, John Brennan even, who I have very little respect
CIA
at this
director.
Point
for, right.
The CIA director, they all said you should tell the White House or at least clear it if you're going to interview the guy, which is the protocol. You need to go through the White House general counsel. But Comey decided to do none of that. He at one point in 2018 bragged at an event with Nicole Wallace at the 72nd Street Y, something along the lines of, well, I wouldn't have gotten away with this in another administration, but I just decided to give it a shot. And lo and behold, he had his deputy call up Mike Flynn saying, I want to send some guys over and ask you about this. And that conversation itself, he's not told that he is a target of an investigation. And Flynn is now, when they finally interview him on the 24th, it's his fourth day on the job as the national security advisor. So he thinks he's talking to some senior FBI guys about Russia. And, and then in addition to all of that, the FBI agents say they don't think he lied, that he didn't show any signs that he was lying. And Comey and McCabe acknowledge this in closed testimony that was only declassified until like the last couple of weeks. Although I guess McCabe is different. But the point of all of this is that this is such, you add all of that together, it's pretty clear that James Comey wanted to get Flynn on whatever he could. He didn't have a viable counterintelligence investigation.
So here's the thing. So the thing I hear most from those who the thing you read most from those who don't accept the case dropped against Flynn is, how can this be? The guy pled guilty. I don't understand this. He pled guilty. How can you now say he didn't do anything? And Eli, you get into that in the piece a bit. Can you talk about why your argument stands and why, well, in fact,
I mean, the first thing to observe on that point is that it is bizarre for liberals and progressives to make this argument, because we have been hearing for the last 30 years about prosecutorial abuse and how innocent people plead guilty all the time in our criminal justice system. And it is one of the sort of key things that civil liberties types have argued, you know, needs to reform, which is, by the way, you know, there's plenty to really criticize about Glenn Greenwald, but give him credit, he has been consistent on this point. But no, everybody else seems to forget that innocent people plead guilty all the time because of prosecutorial pressure. Second of all, there was enormous prosecutorial pressure on Mike Flynn. They were, now here it's a little complicated, because I should say up front that Noah had a great point in a piece that he wrote, I think 2 weeks ago, which is that you can criticize the process, but he had some criticisms of Mike Flynn's choices. I would agree that Mike Flynn taking money to appear at RT, which is not anything to do with this, but the thing is, it's this separate matter, which is that he took a contract with a Dutch company called Novo that was asking him to defame a Turkish clerist named Fethullah Gulen, who has been living in the United States since 1999, and who the president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has blamed for a 2016 attempted military coup that failed. So right after that coup, we know this, I mean, I know because I cover the issue, you know, the Turks were trying to spread a lot of money around Washington to get lobbyists and active advocates for extraditing Gulen. And so this was part of that effort, although some other stories that he was going to kidnap him are not true, which I can get into. But to the point is that he took this contract and he filed it under something called the Lobbying Disclosure Act, which is a less stringent and workaround for the Foreign Agents Registration Act. And lots of people do that. And I don't like that. So if there is a new sort of enforcement environment in Washington where we're going to have more Foreign Agent Registration Act filings, I'm all for it. But there wasn't in August of 2016. And, you know, what he did is something that I can just tell you is done all the time. And so there was, I think, the law is called FARA. There was a FARA investigation that began when Flynn wrote an op-ed on election day that said the U.S. should extradite Gulen because he's the Turkish bin Laden. And that obviously kind of looked very suspicious.
My name was mentioned, moderators, so I'm allowing myself to interject here. Allow me to expand on some of my concerns.
Sure.
Eli, you've untangled a really complicated series of threads here in one of the most comprehensive works that I think has been done on this issue and should be applauded for it. And you note in the piece that General Flynn exhibited some rather bad judgment.
I said which I think horrendous.
Something
I agree.
Of an understatement, frankly. The Mueller probe, we'll just, you know, lay it out a little bit. The Mueller probe indicated that General Flynn's failure to disclose while he was even taking classified briefings and during the transition period, quote, impeded the ability of the public to learn about the Republic of Turkey's efforts to influence public opinion about the failed coup in 2016, including the effort to evacuate the removal of a person legally residing in the United States. This is the Turkish government's Leon Trotsky, for all purposes, this cleric Gulen, further provided a lot of evidence that he lent legitimacy to the regime of Vladimir Putin. And more concerning to me, the extent to which he went to the mattresses in defense of the alt-right in 2016, repeatedly defending the alt-right, repeatedly touting individuals like Mike Cernovich and his bizarre, misogynistic, crack science Bible guerrilla mindset. Right. This was what he dedicated himself to.
Okay,
and so now you have people like Mike Pence saying, I would welcome him back in the White House. The martyring of this guy by the DOJ has now created an incentive, a political incentive on the part of President Trump's allies to reintegrate this guy into the sphere of legitimate opinion on the right. And that would be profoundly mistaken. Two bad things can happen at once. This guy can exhibit really bad judgment. He can also be railroaded by the Justice Department. That doesn't make anybody in the story a good guy.
Right. I just want to say this, though, that what we have here is Robert Mueller using this confusion about the which act Flynn registered under as a lever to try to break Flynn so that Flynn would give him the goods on the Russian collusion. And he goes at Flynn, he bankrupts him with, you know, legal fees, he threatens his son. Flynn then pleads guilty, and Mueller has him. Like, Mueller, he is now Mueller's cat's paw and cooperates. The problem is that there was no actionable Russian collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. And Flynn didn't do it, and Flynn didn't know about it. And what he did with Glenn is unspeakable. It has nothing to do with Mueller's actual writ, which was find out what happened with Russian collusion. So he uses it. He does a classic thing, right? Prosecutors do. Get somebody on a charge and then squeeze them. And he squeezed him. He didn't get anything out of him. And then finally, Flynn regretted his plea and started to make these moves to either seek a pardon or get these things changed, right? So these are all the threads that Eli unravels really, really brilliantly in the piece. It's almost impossible to kind of walk it through verbally because it's so complicated. And let me now pause for a second to go from this very high and complicated discussion to something very simple, which is your comfort and our new sponsor, Tommy John. Because look, working, and I don't mean Tommy John the pitcher, working from home used to be the fantasy of every professional, but it turns out it's not really that comfortable unless you're wearing Tommy John. All that sitting down, standing up, answering the door, answering emails, picking up kids' toys, putting down the dog's bowl, it takes its toll on your layers. Thankfully, Tommy John knows life has its ups and downs. So they've improved their men's underwear, making it more resilient to wear and tear. It's now 2 times more durable, still super soft and breathable, but now even more reliable and comfortable. And right now, when you shop the Tommy John Memorial Day sale, you can get 30% off site-wide. Treat yourself and upgrade to a few pairs of Tommy John underwear in the softest, most breathable fabrics you've ever worn. Tommy John obsesses over every little detail and stitch by using proprietary fabrics that perform like nothing you have ever worn before. All of Tommy John's loungewear and leggings are built for next-level comfort. Whether you're in the hunt for lounge pants, sleep shorts, or lazing around joggers, Tommy John has you covered. They've eliminated visible panty lines for women, and their quick draw fly has been proven to save men over 200 unfurling minutes a year. So look, Tommy John is so confident in their underwear that if you don't love your first pair, you can get a full refund with the best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Tommy John, no adjustment needed. So shop the Memorial Day sale at TommyJohn.com and get up to 30% off site-wide with code COMMENTARY. That's code COMMENTARY for up to 30% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com. See site for details. Anyway, so the railroading of Michael Flynn, you want chapter, verse, and every detail therein there too. Read Eli Lake's piece. It's up on our site at commentarymagazine.com. Now,
can I just respond in
yes,
one
please.
Sense
yes.
to Noah? My only response to that is that, I, as I said, and I say in the piece, I don't defend, and I think it was horrendous judgment to take that Turkey contract, and I think it was horrendous judgment to go to RT. Those are political issues that should be either adjudicated A, first in the election, but B, afterwards. You can deal with it politically. The first journalist to write about this was Chuck Ross. I'm talking about the Turkey contract. And it was well within everyone's rights, from the moderate or never Trump Republicans to Democrats to other journalists, to say, what is going on with this crazy contract from Flynn? And why is he the national security advisor? And that happens all the time in the normal rough and tumble of American politics. What is a complete and total violation of our sort of modern tradition in this regard is for the FBI to get involved in that matter. There is a difference of opinion on everything from the alt-right, Turkey, and Russia with Trump, then fight it out and the newspapers and Congress, and that is the way, that is the proper forum for it. Using the vast powers of the FBI's surveillance and prosecution and investigative authorities to basically set him up to get fired and then to bankrupt him and then to have him plea to a lie that I don't think would ever be proven in court. And I think there's a really strong argument that he never told, at least according to the FBI agents. And even Comey himself said he was it was a close call whether he lied when he was asked about this under testimony. That right there is an abuse. And that's why I think it's important to focus on that story, even though I think that there, I would agree that the three things that you mentioned in Flynn's resume right there are totally fair to criticize. And it doesn't mean that everything Flynn ever did is great. And we should always try to resist that urge to say that everyone on my side is perfect and everyone on the other side is the, you know, the Satan. So I just say that, I mean, that's why I'm focused on what happened, you know,
in without question. We are in heated agreement. Yeah. You can have exculpation without rehabilitation.
Right. You know, it's funny because one of the other main stories this week, which is the journalist on journalist war between Ben Smith of the New York Times on Ronan Farrow of the New Yorker, this piece that Ben wrote, 4,000 word piece on Monday about weaknesses, inconsistencies, and excessive claims in Ronan Farrow's reporting on a lot of these Me Too issues, a very powerful piece. And Ben says in the piece, you know, it's very easy in the world of resistance, Trump-era resistance journalism, to go at villains that everybody agrees are villains and to you know, go at them, and then everybody praises you because you go at them. At those moments, it's even more important to corroborate, establish, and get those facts right, because everybody has a bias toward believing the worst things that you can say about somebody who is so, as say, as unattractive as Harvey Weinstein, let's say. So that piece by Ben Smith has like lit a fire in the world of journalism, and I have a column about it today. And the thing that gets me about it is that the accusations that Ben Smith, who was a very good writer, but was the editor of BuzzFeed, very talented guy, a one-time colleague of Eli's at the New York Sun, as a when they were both strapping young journalists around New York. But you know, Ben himself was guilty of what in my mind was an extraordinary act of journalistic malpractice. 3 years ago, when he published the Steele dossier, a document that he published as the editor of BuzzFeed, arguably the thing that shot BuzzFeed even further into the stratosphere of the necessary reads and publications of our time, while saying that they couldn't corroborate any of the charges, and this thing was around and it was newsworthy, and therefore they were just going to publish it, release it into the ether. And the publication of that document, from which there, I believe not a single claim in the Steele dossier has been corroborated. I mean, there are, I think, 45 or 46 separate allegations in the dossier about Trump and the Russians and various other things, not a single one of which from then until now has been corroborated. The release of that document was something no other journalist who had it, and dozens had been given it, but right before the election and after the election, would publish. And BuzzFeed did anyway. And so for Ben then to turn around and go at Ronan Farrow, I think in ways that are totally legitimate and very serious, acts as what is an interesting bit of maybe you should look in the mirror. You know, maybe you should maybe look at yourself. And then finally, Farrow's most egregious piece, Ben Smith doesn't mention at all, which is his piece about an allegation against Brett Kavanaugh in 2018 about something that Kavanaugh supposedly did as an 18-year-old at Yale, that in the piece itself that he and Jane Mayer did, Farrow did, they have seven or eight supposed witnesses, none of whom corroborated the event.
Right.
And yet they published the piece anyway. So, go ahead. It's Christine.
I was just going to say, but in some weird way, this issue is part of what I think Eli does well laying out in his piece, which is that the bias can go both ways, right? So now the bias, there is a real media bias about protecting the Obama administration's legacy and behavior right now. Obama still remains a very popular public figure. And it's so much so that, you know, some of Trump's campaign aides are worried that him doing this whole hashtag Obamagate thing is actually going to harm Trump more than it, you know, takes away from this legacy. I do think I would like to hear a few words from Eli about how, because it does also speak to this idea that you don't want to turn Flynn into a hero when he was clearly an ethically compromised human being. But in the same way, how does the Obamagate, thing that's caught fire among Trump supporters play into this? And how does it obscure our ability to actually look at where the real injustices occurred in this process? Do you have some thoughts on that?
Yeah, I definitely do. I mean, before I get into it, I think that's an important conversation. I just want to just briefly push back on J-Pod. I do so very warily. I think once it became the biggest news story in the world that there was opposition research, or wasn't called, I guess it was not even opposition research at the time, it wasn't called that, it was just a dossier, was briefed, was so important that the intelligence community briefed it to Obama and Trump, that once that story got out, which was a really malicious leak, given what we know the intelligence community thought about the dossier at the time, that once that happens, I think that publishing the document becomes more defensible than if you just published it out of thin air. Because I'll just give you sort of why I say that. Because if you are a journalist and you find out that the FBI is investigating, corruption at Enron, but you don't have corroboration that corruption at Enron occurred, it is still a story to say that the FBI has reason to at least investigate this, which is different than if you had just said, I think there might be corruption at Enron, but I have no corroboration. So that, I'm saying, I think that was a really deliberate leak that CNN got, that this thing was being briefed, knowing that it was all over Washington, and knowing that a lot of people knew what was in it and wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. I get into this in the piece from the February issue. Once they do that, then I think there is a sort of, at least by the old journalism rules, it's fair game. And then the final thing I would just say on that is that having it all out there, how ridiculous many of these allegations were and how hard to believe they were, in the end helped Trump, because then we had something to go back to say it wasn't just vague allegations the FBI was looking at. It was a specific set of things, none of which panned out. That's important because, you know, now I think there is a really justifiable, to get to your question, Christine, I think hopefully would spark a real revisionism of what we thought in 2017. Now, that hasn't happened. As for Obamagate and what the president says, I think that Barr was very clear on Monday in the White House press conference. Did everybody see that? The attorney general's comments where he said he did not think that he said Obama and Biden are not really the subjects of this investigation. So I think hopefully that pours a lot of cold water on things. And it's just not at this point following where the facts go, because what we know is that Obama knew there was a counterintelligence investigation. He knew that there were these intercepts of Flynn. But that is not in itself even that unusual. The counterintelligence investigations are... the main consumer is the president of the United States. So if the problem is that I think it's pretty obvious. I don't know if Obama personally did this, and I am not, what I'm trying to do in my pieces for commentary is to only use what's on the public record, that we don't know what Obama, he said, I want you to spread this around and I need you to alert, you know, the New York Times or David Ignatius. Well, then, if he did that, he would really be part of things, but we don't know that yet.
Right. All we know, in fact, all we know, yeah. Not to be to defend Obama, that, but you know, is that this document that Susan Rice wrote for the files that was released yesterday, or someone got yesterday, says that Obama said we should do this by the book, but then Comey was asked whether or not Flynn should be briefed on various things.
No, the incoming administration.
The incoming administration should be briefed. And Comey said that he wasn't sure whether they should or not. And then we also know, because you begin your piece with it, that Susan Rice then did, in fact, brief Flynn. Like, she had these conversations with Flynn.
Was it not about the Russia, I should say.
Okay, right. Yeah, but anyway, all I'm saying is that...
Email is not an open and shut... It's the obnoxious habit of the press and observers in this instance is to declare definitive proof one way or the other when we have really ambiguous evidence before us. So this is neither exculpatory for the Obama administration, nor or rather case closed on the Obama administration side, as we're seeing, or evidence of a conspiracy as the Trumpian wing is promoting.
No, you'd actually, I believe reading it, you would have to believe that Obama and Rice deliberately lied in this memo that she wrote to file to protect Obama, because she saw 3 years into the future that it would be necessary to defend Obama from the charge that he had somehow masterminded an investigation into Michael Flynn.
And we should say, one of the things that people say is it's really suspicious that she would write this memo to herself 15 days after the meeting. But I would just say, in Rice's defense, around the same time her mother died, and she was dealing with a lot of personal stress and everything else. And again, there's too much we don't know, but if anything, the memo is yet further proof that Comey, had breached the public trust. Because the question that I have in all of this was, there was this exchange in the recently declassified portion in which Comey said there was no classified evidence but the volume of the calls with Kislyak was unusual. Did the director of the FBI bother to tell the president that he wanted to close the counterintelligence investigation into Mike Flynn at the end of December? And did he, that to me is the huge question in all of this, because it sounds like from that memo that Obama thought that there was an ongoing counterintelligence investigation. And so the volume of phone calls with an incoming national security advisor and the Russian ambassador would be suspicious unless you already knew that the FBI looked into all of this and it was hokum. So for me, again, it shouldn't be Obamagate, it's Comey and McCabe-gate. It's very bad at this point, because I'm not trying to be, a both sides are here, but I really, really try, when there is a lot of evidence against Trump or Republicans or conservatives, you have to acknowledge it, because that's how we sort of move on. And there is a kind of, such a closing of ranks that we see from the kind of initial Russiagate crowd and Democrats, that they won't even acknowledge at this point that what Comey did is horrendous and should never happen again, that I think it is going to lead to a kind of cycle of the politicization of law enforcement and, frankly, the criminalization of politics.
Why liberals, and we can maybe end on this point, but why liberals have put themselves in a position of playing this blocking tackle role for James Comey, who arguably, through the election to Trump, remains the greatest mystery of my lifetime? I said at the time that Rod Rosenstein wrote his memo defending the Comey firing by Trump, that everything that we knew about Comey suggested that Obama should have fired him on July 2nd, 2016, when he gave that press conference explaining why he was not proceeding with an indictment of Hillary Clinton, which itself was an extraordinary breach of appropriate behavior by an investigatory body. When you finish an investigation and you close it on the grounds that it does not rise to the level of indictment, nobody should even know. Now, granted, we knew there was an investigation, but you don't explain it. You don't say, you know what, we could have, but we didn't. That was a firing offense. He should have been impeached. The House should have, had his head. The Senate should have investigated him. And then the reopening of the investigation in October, basically, I think, history will probably suggest that that is what one won Trump the election. That's on Comey. That's on James Comey. That's not Obamagate. That's not everybody has a reason to hate Comey now. Liberals do. Conservatives do. Civil libertarians do. People who believe in the, you know, in the role and function, proper function of the FBI do. Everybody does. And there he stands there, 6'8" tall, with his no tie and is wandering around and his 2 million book sales, and somehow comes out of this, maybe not clean as a whistle, but pretty clean. And
you could say the same about McCabe, who sat on this evidence in a very in a deliberate fashion for just long enough to get to the end of October, at which point they had that press conference, that the release of the information that Hillary Clinton was still under investigation, and the cascading series of events you describe unfolded. And he is now a hero, as Eli wrote in his piece. He's a CNN contributor and very authoritative figure on law enforcement matters, when he should be reviled by Democrats for putting them in this particular
position. My dream is for there to be a CNN McCabe interview where Jake Tapper says, and now in the latest developments on Flynn, we turn to Andrew McCabe. As someone who has experience lying repeatedly to FBI investigators, where do you see the stakes case stands at this moment? And it's just unbelievable to me that McCabe is, according to the Inspector General of the Justice Department, appointed by Obama, a repeated liar. And he is somebody who is commenting on the case of Mike Flynn, who didn't even lie to FBI agents. Incredible. My head's exploding. It will continue to explode.
On the matter of Comey, to me, the most galling aspect of it is that whenever he's pushed on any of this, he gives this earnest, heartfelt speech about how he's done everything he's done is to protect the integrity of the FBI and its image, and to make sure that its reputation is not tarnished throughout this.
Right. Well, there we go. So, Eli Lake, thank you so much for joining us again. Everybody, again, The Railroading of Michael Flynn at commentarymagazine.com. Go there right now. Read it. Subscribe. Come back tomorrow. We'll be here tomorrow. For Christine, Abe, and Noah, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.